How can there be calls to nationalize healthcare when the nationalized systems in places like Italy and the UK are worse than we are right now? And I mean much worse. Are we all that stupid or just deaf to all the details? I'm going to show you a graph with data from Oxford University, but it was organized by the U.S.-based Crime Prevention Research Center to show the cumulative percent of each country's population dying from coronavirus. You're not going to see this in the media. You see all the countries above the United States? All of those countries have socialized health care. More people are dying under those socialized systems. Why would we switch to their system when we're doing better than all of them? Let me give you some actual facts here. And by the way, please find these in my book, Arguing with Socialists. You will not find the coronavirus facts, but you will find all of the healthcare facts so you can argue using their own words. Let me take Italian hospitals. They are so overwhelmed right now, they're having to pick and choose who dies. Remember death panels? They're running so low on ventilators that they're modifying scuba masks as a substitute. This is the system that we should be emulating? If there's one thing you can guarantee, it's that if you have government nationalized healthcare, you're going to get high marks for your system, never mind the fact that it's inefficient and provides really crappy care. Italy, laughably, has the number two ranked system in the world. But if you actually lived in Italy, you'd know that people have been complaining about their healthcare for years. Drug prices are through the roof. Doctors are underpaid and overworked. Everything relies on whether the politicians agree to allocate money to the system. That means low salaries for doctors, long wait times for patients. In fact, from 2005 to 2015, over 10,000 doctors left Italy to work in other countries because the system is broken. The average wait time to see a specialist is 67 days. Now let's compare Italy and Germany real quick. Both have roughly the same amount of coronavirus cases, but Germany has a fraction of the amount of deaths. Their hospitals are not overwhelmed, and they're not running out of ventilators. So what gives? Well, the Italian hospitals only have 2.62 beds per 1,000 people. The Germans, however, provide over twice that capacity. They have 6.06 hospital beds per 1,000 people. In fact, it's now being said that they have an oversupply of hospital beds, and that's the reason they're so equipped to handle this outbreak. Both the Italian and the German systems have heavy government involvement, but the German system is a hybrid split between the government and the private sector. In Germany, the healthcare system only relies on 6% of the funding from the government, but in Italy, the government provides over 74%. So this teaches us that the more reliant a system is on the government, the worse it is. But you're not going to hear these facts from people like Michael Moore, and you're not going to hear it from Bernie Sanders or anybody that's part of the Democratic Socialists of America or anyone on CNN or ABC. All they do is just point to systems like the NHS in the UK and say, well, when will the United States finally catch up to, you know, England and Europe? Well, let me show you an article from the New York Times regarding the left's progressive flagship system in the UK. You think New York has it bad right now? Listen to this. NHS overwhelmed in Britain, leaving patients to wait. The article goes on to describe 12-hour emergency sick wait times, sick people crammed in the hallways, non-urgent surgeries are canceled. Specifically, they point the finger at budget cuts. The exact same reason the system in Italy has faced criticism over the past decade. Now, I want you to listen to this quote. Quote, over the past week, hospitals have increasingly declared black alerts, an admission that they are unable to cope with the demand. The health service confirmed without releasing numbers. Most hospitals have been unable to meet emergency ward targets of seeing patients within 4 hours because of the shortage of beds and staff, end quote. So you have overcrowded hospitals, black alerts, impossible wait times, patients crowding the hallways. It sounds apocalyptic. The system is clearly failing. How can you say that? That's what's happening in New York. No, it's not what's happening in New York. It's bad in New York, but it's not that bad. And I just want to, if you would, just take a look at the date of this article. This article was 2 years ago. This is business as usual in a healthcare system in the UK that's run by the government. This happens every flu season. Forget about a global pandemic. This is socialized medicine and how it operates even for the common flu. Look at all of the stories that sound more like horror movies to us coming out of the UK today. The NHS is canceling non-urgent procedures to try to free up beds. The government is scrambling to try to make up for the shortage of doctors and nurses. Much of this happens every year in countries with socialized medicine. Like Italy, the healthcare system in the UK relies on over 3/4 of the budget from the government. This is what you get when suits in the government roll the dice and say, you know what, we're going to spend that money elsewhere. Your doctor and your health wind up being lower on the totem pole that year. And this is the system the Democrats claim will help us fight the next pandemic? No, thank you. Again, I want you to know, our system is not perfect. In fact, I think most of us can agree something needs to change. But the problem is, the only debate we're having right now is whether to keep things the way they are, socialism light, or full-on nationalization. There isn't a single call for a free market option. And this might be the greatest single fallacy for people on our side that are trying to argue with healthcare socialists. They try to argue that the system that we have is actually free market, but it isn't. Progressives have been nipping away at healthcare in this country for over a century. Woodrow Wilson first proposed single payer around World War I. It's not a new idea. FDR revived it during World War II. And after years of baby steps, LBJ created Medicare and Medicaid in the 1970s. Today, the monstrosity that we call the U.S. healthcare spends more in government funding than any country in the world. 17.1% of our GDP all goes to healthcare. That's more than countries that have fully nationalized systems. This is insane, and it's the reason why prices are skyrocketing. More government involvement equals inefficiency and higher cost. Harry Dent, the author of the book Zero Hour, he put it out quite a while ago, and it's beginning to look like, now's the time. We should have all read that book. He was on the program in the fall, and he said, we are going to hit around March, and we're going to hit a Great Depression. He did, you know, nobody knew about the coronavirus, but that was the trigger that forced this house of cards down. Harry, we talked about the stock market and everything else last hour. I want to talk to you about things like, for instance, inflation versus deflation. We're probably headed for deflation where nothing has real value. Our homes are worth about half, right? Is that what we're headed towards?
Yeah. Basically, when the central banks inflated all this money, they didn't give it to consumers or even put it into the banking system or businesses or anything like they're finally doing this. They just bought financial assets from banks to give them liquidity to keep them from going under, and they ignited a huge financial asset bubble. And so stocks and real estate, stocks the most, then real estate, those type of and most bonds are way overvalued, and they have to reset back down to reality. That's going to destroy a lot of money.
Okay.
There's money in your bank
account
you spend, but there's money in your brokerage account that's going to disappear even more. That's money.
So if you can sell your house or have to sell your house, now is the time to do. I mean, you know, there's no better time than right now. But if you don't have to, can you ride this out? I mean, what does it look at? Does it come back in 5-6 years?
It does not, Glenn. For the first time in history, we have a smaller generation following a larger one. The baby boom peaked around the world, and particularly here in the United States, in births in the early 60s, and then their inflation impact 20 years later, right, when they hit the workforce in the 70s. So that's done. We're never going to have that much growth again. And now the baby boomers are dying faster than the millennials coming along to buy. Real estate will not come back fast and will not come back new. I advise selling all non-strategic real estate and real estate that's bubbly. Even I'm not living in, I'm not owning my primary home, but I own my vacation home on an island because it's going to, you know, better zoning and it's a special place. I don't even own my primary home right now. I'm willing to buy after this. You're going to get the bargain of your life. Here's the difference in real estate. What you said is to sell real estate right now. You've got less time. Real estate freezes up in a crash. Stocks, even when you're late, you can still sell. They're very liquid. Same with high quality bonds and stuff. You've got to move on real estate now. Stocks, I'd say more like August, September, October into the election is going to be the time to sell at an even better price, especially if we go lower first. So real estate is the hardest to get out of, and you're going to get the biggest penalty if you wait because it just freezes up and nobody wants to buy it.
So we have 20%, let's just say, 20% unemployment. When does that number start to come down, Harry?
Okay, first of all, three scenarios in the past, the 80 to 82 deep recession, then 29 to 32 bubble crash, and the 2000 to 2000 tech bubble crash, all have the same shape. There's nothing black swan about this, Glenn. It starts with the first crash when the reality sets in and the bubble bursts. We're in that now. That's going to cause a sharp, sudden downturn in the economy like happened in the first half of 1980. Then all the stimulus will cause a quarter or two of rebound, but that won't work because too much damage has been done, and we go into a two-year slide into deleveraging, deflation of assets. That's when deflation sets in before inflation follows after. So deflation does come first and then inflation. So that's important to understand. The deflation is about loans being restructured and financial assets coming down to reality. And that's where you lose your money. That's where your business gets in trouble if you're not ahead of it and hunker down. That's where people get unemployed. And all this sort of stuff. And so you have to be ahead of this on every minute. If you got a good job, be nice to your boss and keep it. If you can do something on the side for business, do that. If you can hunker down on your business, cut costs ahead of your competitors. The point of this whole thing is to get the economy healthy again, out of debt, into reality, prices back to where people can invest in the future and afford to buy a home, healthy, but that's going to be painful. You got to get out of the way. If your business just survives this downturn, you're going to have double the market share for years and decades to come. You're going to come out stronger than ever. If you, like Joseph Kennedy, sold his stocks at the top and then rebuy when they're down 70, 80, 90%, you're going to have the greatest gains in your life.
Yeah, my grandfather used to say he lived through the Great Depression. He said those who had money, those who didn't lose it right at the beginning, they made a killing.
And the business, General Motors, right, passed Ford forever and became the largest, right, corporation in the world.
Right.
Out of that.
Right. General Motors, everybody in business should read about what General Motors did in World War II and the Great Depression, because they were the real winners. They were really ahead of the game.
The other big winner was the Mafia. The Mafia played the boom, the roaring 20s, bootlegging, and became the loan shark for small businesses in the Depression, and just hit a home run both ways. But the Mafia probably played, Mafia, General Motors, Joseph Kennedy are the three great examples of how you make a fortune in a crash instead of losing most of your asset.
And only one of them was really legitimate. Harry, let me go to the people who are, and I mean, what do restaurants look like? I mean, I don't know how the mom and pop restaurant survives this.
Okay, look, I went to the hurricane in Puerto Rico. We were totally out for 3 months. When we get back, you crawl back, and guess what? I had 21 restaurants within a block and a half of my condo. And 6 out of 7 good ones went under and never came back, and 1 out of 3 of the bad ones went under and never came back, the cheapos. And they just don't come back because a lot of businesses are already over in debt or have weak market positions. This just brings that all out. So people who think, oh, this is just the virus, and when it goes back, all this stimulus, V-shaped recovery, there is no V-shaped recovery to this. No way. Only stocks will try that, and they will fail.
All right. So let me go back to the unemployment. When do we start seeing, because we have significant unrest if we have 20% unemployment for very long.
Oh, my God, yeah. Another reason I'm glad I'm in Puerto Rico, Glenn. We've been in 14 years of recession and no civil unrest. Okay, 80-82 is a great example. So is the 30s, but that's more reason. The first shock, unemployment went up to 8%. And then when GDP came back for a quarter, quarter and a half, all it did was kind of edge back down to like 7% because it's still the economy's weak, like I said. You don't come V-shaped out of it. And then in the next phase, late 81, 82, it went up to 11%. So double those figures. This time, let's call that 15% plus in the first shock. And then you go down a little bit. And then you go to 20, 25% in the longer shock. This is serious. There is going to be civil unrest. It's going to get a point where the government can't backstop every small business and every person like they're doing. You got to realize, Glenn, the government this time, after the last shock and stimulating for 9 to 11 years, nobody knows better than the central banks how weak the economy is because they keep pumping Viagra into this thing and nothing happens. And so they're blowing their whole wad right at the beginning. What else can they do? And there's no. I tell small businesses, get every subsidy or loan you'll get right now. Consumers, get anything you can get. Be first in line because this is going to run out. And don't have your money in normal bank accounts other than pay your bills. Have it in a brokerage account in safe haven investments under your own name that cannot be lent against and lose that money. The government can't back all the bank accounts in the country either. So you have to get safe. You can't listen to Warren Buffett or the experts or Wall Street or politicians. They'll tell you this is okay. Don't panic. This is one time you should panic and cover your assets.
So wait. So where is what is the safe haven?
Okay. Number one, we just saw it, Glenn. We just saw it except for one exception. I told people the number one is the 10 and 30-year, yes, U.S. Treasury bonds because they won't default. You know, they have to print money to pay them off. Second is AAA, only the highest quality corporate bonds don't have the default risk when interest rates go down. So bonds like interest rates going down, but only the highest quality. Well, guess what? In this crash, the 10-year, the Treasury bonds did great. The AAA corporates didn't do so well because when you see you're a cruise line or an airline or a retail store and you see 50 to 80% declines, your AAA rating turns into junk overnight and you trade like a junk bond. So really it's the Treasury bonds at first, and then when things settle down, the AAA. So that is the best.
So do you have belief in a long-term treasury? You know, you say, well, they'll just print their money. They have to pay out. Okay. Well, I mean, the money has no value.
No, that's not true, Glenn. Currencies trade relative to each other. And I can tell you this. I've said this for years. Nobody gets it till it happens. It happened in 2008. When the Lehman Brothers and things went the worst, the U.S. dollar went up 28% and all the other currencies went down. We are not a good house. We're just the best house in a bad neighborhood. Japan has printed 105% of their GDP. Now we're at 20. Europe's at 42. Now we're all amping up again. We are the best house. We're still the reserve currency. Loans around the world are made in dollars. When those loans go bad, especially in the emerging world, dollars are going to disappear. There's going to be fewer dollars, which means they're worth more temporarily. I say the U.S. dollar, and particularly the U.S. Treasury bonds and highest quality corporate bonds, hold up the best in deflation at first. After that, no, I'm not in the dollar after that. The dollar just does well as the best house in the crisis like it did in 2008. When we go into the next boom, it's all going to be about Asia and even less about China. It's going to be about India, Southeast Asia. There's nothing the U.S. is going to be the reserve currency in the future. I'm just saying the U.S. dollar, I mean, there's not enough gold to back everything. And cryptos are the biggest bubble of all. I've been saying the cryptos are going to go down the most. When this happens,
it's crazy.
Have already proven not to be. Now, just recently, in just this first crash, Treasury bonds did the best. The U.S. dollar went up. Other currencies went down. Gold went up in the early stages, as it did in 2008, and then retreated some. Gold was still the next best to those high-quality bonds because it held its value better than other commodities and way better than stocks. But the ultimate safe haven, I'm telling you, it's going to be the 10- to 30-year Treasury bond during the crisis. After that, those very treasury bonds and all bonds are going to go into a 20-year plus bear market with rising rates. Inflation's going to follow, not high inflation, but gnawing inflation's going to follow this crisis, and bonds are going to be trash. But in this crisis, only the best ones. Just sitting in cash. Like, I'd have high-quality bond, I'd have some gold, it's also a great diversifier, and that's it. And if you want to hedge, you can put some money in a simple, unleveraged inverse fund. S&P 500, you know how to bet against that? You buy SH, SPY on the way up, SH, will just go down. If the S&P goes down, you know, 40% here, then you're up 40, and it ultimately goes down 80, you're up 80, and you're not unleveraged, not going to get margin calls, you just sit on it, and maybe you put 10 or 20% of your portfolio in that. So small amount inverse funds, small amount in gold, a lot in high quality bonds. That's where I would be. But you have now, you're going to have several months to prepare for this. So it's the real estate you should focus on first, because that just dries up. And I've seen that happen time and time again.
For the first time in all of U.S. history, all 50 states are now declared disaster zones. This is why everything is overwhelmed. This has never happened before. Should we cue the fat lady on the free market system? The U.S. Federal Reserve is now purchasing approximately $625 billion per week in U.S. Treasury bonds, U.S. municipal bonds, and corporate bonds. So they're buying stocks, your city, and they're buying Treasury bonds. $625 billion per week, $1.2 trillion every 2 weeks. I don't know. Sounds like a problem. At that rate of spend, the Federal Reserve will own all outstanding U.S. public debt, federal and local debt, by September or October of this year. Let me say that again. The Federal Reserve will own all outstanding U.S. public debt, federal and local debt, by September of next year, of this year. It will own all U.S. private and corporate debt by December. The Federal Reserve is already, now, today, the largest single U.S. government bonds of $20 trillion in outstanding U.S. debt. The Federal Reserve owns approximately $5.7 trillion and is now adding $1 trillion in new bond purchases every 2 weeks. This comes as the Bank of England skips the bond market entirely and is just printing new currency to fund UK expenditures directly. This is modern monetary theory. You don't have to have a way to pay for it. You just print it. As of this week, the Fed's Open Market Committee meeting, the Fed will also be willing to purchase so-called junk bonds from all U.S. companies that are in distress. The Fed has also issued a new fund to buy U.S. mortgage assets from banks, pledging $200 billion to U.S. banks plus Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to buy distressed mortgages that become insolvent due to COVID-19. The U.S. Federal Reserve is now officially the largest landowner in the world. Again, let me say that. The U.S. Federal Reserve is now officially the largest landowner in the world. At this point, the only major asset in U.S. equity markets the Fed is not directly buying are U.S. stocks. However, that's on the way. Deutsche Bank said last week, because of what the Fed is doing, they're quoting, "Is no such thing as a free market anymore," end quote. By the way, just a note on this, it is you, the U.S. taxpayer, responsible for all of this debt, not the Fed. The Treasury, using the Exchange Stabilization Fund, will make an equity investment in each Fed fund and is in the first lost position, making you, the taxpayer, responsible should any of these investments or underlying funds fail. As such, the U.S. Treasury, not the Fed, is actually buying all of these securities and backstopping all of these loans. The Fed is only acting as a banker and providing that financing. You say we don't need to open up the economy? Just think about that. The U.S. could face rolling lockdowns and social distancing orders for 18 to 24 months, this according to the U.S. Federal Reserve. Without an effective therapy or vaccine, the U.S. economy could face 18 months of rolling shutdowns as the outbreak recedes locally and then flares up again. Hunt for a vaccine continues. A year, according to scientists, a year would be a miracle. Kentucky churchgoers are not alone. They were met with nails in the road and surveillance of license plates because the mayor decided there wasn't going to be any church services anywhere in Kentucky. That's the governor, I should say, not the mayor. He urged residents to remain indoors for the Easter holiday, and they are enforcing with state troopers and county sheriffs. The mayor of Louisville also came out and had draconian measures. The DOJ states First Amendment is still the First Amendment. A federal judge ruled that this weekend. An attorney general, William Barr, indicated the DOJ is monitoring state and local government actions related to limitations on religious services and will potentially prosecute local officials if they violate the civil rights of religious people. Are our oil wars over? Maybe, maybe not, because of Mexico. And is democracy the ultimate COVID-19 victim? France and Bolivia have postponed elections now. Peru has handed its president broad new legislative authority. Israel sharply ramped up the reach of its surveillance state. The U.S., we're curtailing religious services and searching for out-of-staters door-to-door states. While leaders around the world are fighting the spread of the coronavirus, they're also amassing sweeping new powers. As legislatures limit or suspend activities in the name of social distancing, many of the norms that define our free market and our democracy, elections, deliberation, debate, checks and balances, have all been put on indefinite hold. The speed and breadth of the transformation is unsettling to political scientists all over the world, government watchdogs and rights groups. Many concede emergency declarations and streamlining government decision-making are necessary responses to the global threat, but they question how readily leaders are going to give these powers up. We've all put our economies on hold. Can we have an open debate on when we bring those back? We've also put democracy on hold. Are we going to talk about bringing those things back as well? Also, the cost of COVID-19 phase one and two bailout. NASA's budget for the next 207 years. The cost of the $4.7 trillion bailout package equates to NASA's $22.6 billion that they get every year for the next 207 years. The cost of the bailout, put in other words, is equal to fully funding six Mars landers, rovers, missions to the red planet every single day. Just the phase two of the deal, $2 trillion, is $7,500 per American, or $16,500 per taxpayer, seeing that only half of our citizens pay taxes. No word yet on why it costs $7,500 in actual taxpayer cost for each American to receive a $1,200 stimulus check. We don't know. One of the guys who saw this pandemic for what it was early on was on our program, among other programs, trying to ring the bell, is Senator Tom Cotton, and he is joining us now. Senator, how are you, sir?
Hey, Glenn, it's good to be on with you again. Thank you for having me.
You bet. So you're getting credit from a lot of places as being the guy who saw this coming, but is it because or because you take China for what we know China is, not for what we hope China is?
Well, Glenn, it's certainly far from any claim that I'm a genius, but it does have a lot to do with a clear-eyed view of the Chinese Communist Party going back many years leading up to this pandemic outbreak. Specifically in January, as I began to see information in public news sources, not in classified intelligence briefings that I received, just in public news sources, sometimes obscure or foreign sources like East Asian news outlets or medical journals, I saw a clear contrast between two things. On the one hand, you had the rhetoric of the Chinese Communist Party, which was designed to minimize the threat, soothe over fears, tell everyone everything was okay, don't worry, we've got it under control, this can't be transmitted from humans to humans. Contrast that with the Chinese Communist Party's actions, which were extreme and draconian, shutting down a city that is larger than New York City, literally boarding up doors or welding doors shut on high-rise apartment buildings, allowing the Hong Kong local government to shut down all air travel from the Chinese mainland, shutting down schools, not just in Wuhan, but across the country, all 1.3 billion people worth. When the contrast between that rhetoric and those actions told me that the Chinese Communist Party understood just how grave this virus could become, and is therefore the reason why I started sounding the alarm in mid-January and urging the president to shut down travel with China, which thankfully he did by the end of January.
So Senator, I have been concerned about this coronavirus because, for the same reasons, watching what China was doing, thinking this is nuts. They don't ever do stuff like this. But I think we're going to be proven to be accurate on this. I was less concerned about the death toll that it would take on the rest of the world than I was the toll on the free market system. We are facing a possible depression, and we've got people in Congress that are, I think, cheering for this. They are looking to hurt the economy in any way to change the capitalist system into a socialized system. I think we are at a place where our Constitution and our way of life is on the ropes, mainly because of the people in Congress.
Well, Glenn, I would put the responsibility for what we're going through first and foremost at the feet of the Chinese Communist Party. They had a chance to keep this virus a local health problem in Wuhan. Instead, they allowed it to become a global pandemic. And to give you a sense of the extent of Chinese treachery, on January 23rd, the Chinese Communist Party shut down all travel by airplane out of Wuhan inside of China. So you couldn't fly from Wuhan to Shanghai or to Beijing or anywhere else inside China. But they allowed international air travel from Wuhan to continue. So you could continue to fly from Wuhan to other places in the world, to include New York and San Francisco. That gives you a sense of their treachery in this matter. Now, your more fundamental point, though, is very important, and I share your concern about what this virus has done to jobs and our economy, not just here in the United States, but in all of our allied countries as well as Europe, in Japan, in Singapore, in Taiwan, in South Korea, what has happened across the civilized democratic world. And that's why it is so important that we give our people the confidence that the virus is under control, that they're less likely to get it, and that if they do get it, the healthcare system will be functioning for them. Because that is ultimately what has caused the economy across the Western world to come grinding to a halt. You know, Donald Trump didn't shut down the economy. The president doesn't have that authority in our system. Even our governors and mayors, who in many cases have been aggressively saying what kinds of activities will be permitted, are more or less just reflecting reality. If you look at where the state of the economy was in Europe and the United States in the first half of March, before many governments were taking this action, you'll see that our people were voluntarily and spontaneously starting to stay home. If you look at, like, say, open table bookings for restaurants or airline travel or so forth. So it's not so much a government dictate that has caused the economy to grind to a halt. It is our people's understandable fears of the virus. That's why it's so important.
But Senator, I think that there are governors that are taking, I mean, the governor of Michigan just banned advertising for products that aren't essential. What is that? I mean, I think there are those who are taking their powers, so to speak, way too far.
Yeah, there's no doubt, for instance, that some governors, I think, have made mistakes. Don't get me wrong. You know, I have not heard about the ban on advertising for any so-called non-essential activity. But, you know, someone might say a Lego set is not essential. Well, if you've got a four-year-old kid at home or three-year-old kid, as I do, I can tell you it's pretty essential to have Legos for them. Mm-hmm. Likewise, in Virginia, the governor extended the stay-at-home order until, I think, mid-June. Maybe that'll end up being necessary, Glenn, but we don't know that now. We don't know it in Virginia. We don't know it in Arkansas. We don't know. That's why President Trump has only suggested it continue until the end of April. We can take stock in another 10 or 15 days about where we stand. So there's no doubt that some governors and mayors have made bad decisions. But in the end, what is more important than what any governor or mayor does is that we have the techniques and the practices in place that we can stop the population-wide measures we have now and return to traditional public health control, which is case-based measures. So rather than saying everyone needs to stay at home, we can just identify those people who are sick and those people who have been around them and tell them, you individually need to stay at home. And the president outlines that at his press conferences and what we're doing in terms of getting testing up on a rapid basis, getting antibody testing, producing masks, not just for doctors and nurses, but for people at the workplace, and so on and so forth. That's how we give people confidence to get back to something like normal life.
And do you have confidence that we are taking the steps right now? I know we ordered 500 million masks for the stockpile. We're ordering all kinds of medicine, et cetera, et cetera. Hopefully these tests come online. But are you comfortable that if this thing comes back with a vengeance in the fall, we're not going to have to go in shutdown again? We'll have the tools to make sure that our medical system won't collapse on us.
Well, first off, Glenn, because there's so much unknown about the virus still, I don't want to say I have total confidence in that. There are no guarantees right
but
now.
But we're taking the steps that we know. You feel we're taking those steps that we should be taking?
At this point, after a false start or two related to testing at the CDC and FDA in early February, we are rapidly scaling up our testing capacity as quickly as we can. The world's very best medical researchers and scientists are looking into every angle for possible prophylactic drugs, therapeutic drugs, and vaccines. We are producing the kind of, again, personal protective equipment, not just for doctors and nurses, which we, of course, must have, but for people to get back to work. So if they're working on the factory line, they can have the masks that they need. Because ultimately, it's those steps that will allow us to get back to something like normal, so we can get out of the situation we're in now, which is buying time through population-based measures to produce all those things.
So, Senator, we're talking to Senator Tom Cotton, the guy who was leading the charge on the coronavirus. Let me take you back to China for a second. what they've done, you could argue, is an act of war. I mean, they've killed more people than died in World War I, by far. They have disrupted our economy. Anybody who would do this as a terrorist strike, it would be war. I don't want war, and I'm not suggesting war, but our relationship with China cannot go back to the way it was, where we just say and we ship all of our business over to them. Agree or disagree?
That's exactly right, Glenn. I can already tell you that public opinion in this country ran very strongly against China, no matter what business or financial or media elites believe. That's because a lot of Americans to be hostile towards China. If you work in a factory and your job has been outsourced to China, if your industry, like rice farmers in Arkansas, have seen their proprietary intellectual property stolen or their computer systems hacked, if you're appalled by the way China forces women to have abortions or harvest organs from political prisoners or smashes Christian churches or interns, religious minorities, in mass gulags. And now to top it off, they've unleashed a pandemic on the entire world. So things are going to change, and they're going to change rapidly, not just in the United States, but all around the civilized world. Because I can tell you, public opinion in America, and not just America, views China as a pariah state.
Ivermectin is an FDA-approved medication for parasitic infections. Ivermectin is widely available due to its inclusion on the WHO model list of essential medicines. It opens glutamate-sensitive chloride channel currents in helminths, and it's widely believed that this is how it kills certain parasites. It's the drug of choice for the treatment of onchocerciasis and strongyloidiasis, both of which are parasitic infections. Ivermectin is effective against several intestinal nematodes, including ascariasis, trichoriasis, and also cutaneous larva migrans, also Wuchereria bancrofti, Brugia malayi, Mansonella azardi, and Loa Loa. It also is effective against scabies and head lice. So why might ivermectin work against SARS coronavirus 2, the virus that causes COVID-19? Well, once the virus gains entry into the cells of the body using the ACE2 receptor, the virus releases its messenger RNA into the cell. The cell starts to translate the messenger RNA from the virus, which starts to make viral proteins, and that's how new virus forms. But some of these viral proteins that are freshly made then enter into the nucleus of the cell, or at least are thought to do so by many scientists. And this probably impairs our cell's ability to fight off the infection. The way these viral proteins are thought to gain entry into the nucleus of our cells is through specific channels that are made out of a different protein called importin. Not important, it's importin. There's importin type alpha and type beta, or IMP alpha and IMP beta for short. And this is where ivermectin comes in, because ivermectin inhibits the passage of these viral proteins into the nucleus. It does so by binding to these protein channels and effectively blocking the transport of molecules through them. So this is why scientists started studying ivermectin. And here we have this article that just came out April 3rd in the journal Antiviral Research. This is a pre-proof article, meaning they've been peer-reviewed, but final publication is still pending. What these scientists found is that ivermectin significantly inhibits the SARS-2 coronavirus viral proteins in their passage from the cytoplasm into the nucleus of the cells in vitro. In vitro means this was done in a test tube or outside of a living organism. So a single dose of ivermectin had a 5,000-fold reduction in virus levels at 48 hours in cell culture. So this drug has a huge impact on this virus in vitro. And that's why the authors of this study conclude that these drugs need to be studied in COVID-19 patients, meaning in clinical trials, the same way that other drugs are being looked at in clinical trials for COVID-19, such as remdesivir, chloroquine, and hydroxychloroquine. So because ivermectin is generally considered a safe drug and is already FDA approved for other diseases, it can be repurposed for COVID-19 as long as it's shown to be safe and effective for COVID-19 in patients in these clinical trials. Now, if this drug turns out to be the miracle drug for COVID-19, the next question will become, when should it be started? In other words, at what point does someone start taking this medication? Should they take it prophylactically, or should they take it as soon as they start getting symptoms? But we're not even at that point yet. First, we have to do the clinical trials to see if it is effective for COVID-19. The other question is, what are the side effects of ivermectin, or adverse reactions? Well, based on what we already know about ivermectin, this is what I can tell you. The most common adverse reaction is the Mezaty reaction. But this only happens when ivermectin is used to treat onchocerciasis, which is a parasitic infection. Now, what is the Mezaty reaction, you ask? It was first described in 1948. It's a symptom complex seen in patients after undergoing treatment of nematode infestation, particularly with the medication diethylcarbamazine, or DEC for short, but it also occurs with ivermectin. Mezaty reactions can be life-threatening and are characterized by fever, hives, generalized swelling, swollen lymph nodes, fast heart rate, low blood pressure, joint pain, and abdominal pain. There's a 25% chance of Mezaty reaction when ivermectin is used to treat onchocerciasis, but not other parasitic infections. So if a COVID-19 patient took ivermectin, this would not happen. So otherwise, ivermectin is considered very safe and side effects are uncommon. Diarrhea occurs in about 2% of people taking it. Also, ivermectin should not be administered to pregnant or lactating women, and its safety in children who weigh less than 15 kilograms is still not known.